Oh, yeah, do the record. Record to this computer on the cloud.
Recording in progress.
And then unmute. I can't see. There you go.
Good evening. My name is John Kilkenny, Vice Chair of the Morrow County Planning Commission. I will be presiding over the meeting tonight. Persons who wish to provide testimony may do so orally or in writing. Testimony and evidence must be directed towards the applicable area criteria.
John, do you want to do member entry, like go to the agenda and do take roll call? That's prior to the hearing. Sorry. Sorry, right. That's our bad. Sorry to. We do the call of order.
We predicted it.
All right.
That's it. You're on the right page. Yep.
Call the meeting to order. We'll do start with the roll call.
Yes, Commissioner Anderson.
Present.
Commissioner Cooley. Commissioner.
Tamara, you're muted.
Okay, thanks.
Chair Ekstrom. Commissioner Finch.
Hold on. Oh, okay.
Vice Chair Kilkenny.
Here.
Commissioner Killian.
Here.
Commissioner Peterson.
Here.
Commissioner Smith.
Here.
And Commissioner Thompson.
Here.
Okay, you have a quorum.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Has everyone had a chance to review the minutes from February 27th, 2024? Motion to approve those minutes.
I motion to approve the minutes from
February 27th. I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
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 There's Brett. Okay, so now, is this when we go to the statement, or we go to the...
Yes, that's right, yeah. Okay. Sorry, that's your script for, make sure the first one is there. Just sorry about that, Sean.
Yes, this
one. This is, I did the statement first. And
internet
then,
access
and then
only.
And that's your checklist, that's right.
Internet yeah. Access only.
We'll start over again. Good evening, my name is John Kilkenny, Vice Chair of the Morrow County Planning Commission. I'll be presiding over the meeting tonight. Persons who wish to provide testimony may do so orally or in writing. Testimony and evidence must be directed towards the applicable criteria. Failure to raise an issue accompanied by statements or evidence sufficient to afford the decision makers and parties an opportunity to respond to the issues precludes the appeal to the Board of Commissioners on that issue. Please sign the worksheet in the back of the room or make a note in chat if you're participating via Zoom. If you would like to present testimony, please speak only when identified by the chair and begin giving your name, spelling of your name, and your address. If you have exhibits for consideration, please provide the staff a copy. If you'd like to request the commission to hold open the record or continue the hearing, you must make that request before the public portion of the hearing is closed. This concludes the introduction. So I call this to order, and the first action tonight is AC 15324 Comprehensive Plan Amendment Goal Exception for Passive Solar One Energy.
And Daisy's the planner on that one.
Perfect. Thank you. So thank you to the folks from Xera who came in from Denver, and Elaine Albrecht from David Wright Tremaine, who's on the call, They submitted a really great package, and we were able to review and presented the staff report with their attachments. This we are going to be processing the both the comprehensive plan amendment and the CUP in conjunction. And we discussed this a little bit with Elaine earlier that we don't want to separate them where we would approve the CUP and then maybe like continue the comprehensive plan amendment. We would want, if one of them is continued, we want you guys to all to continue both items. And if one is approved, so and so forth. The comprehensive plan amendment, of course, then goes on to the Board of Commissioners if you guys recommend it for approval, and then they'll review that portion of it. But if there's questions or anything that's unclear about one portion or the other, we'd just like them to stay together, because a lot of the aspects of the CUP are dependent on the approval of the comprehensive plan amendment. So the gist of the project is that it's going to be 753 acres of a solar farm, up to 120 megawatts, and a battery storage system. So in order to get that approved, if it's more than 12 acres of high-value farmland or more than 20 acres of arable land, it goes through not only the conditional use process, but also the exception to Goal 3, which is the agricultural goal. And so they're applying for both in conjunction, so it, just like any conditional use permit, but it's also in conjunction with the exception to our agricultural lands element. So one we ended up putting all of the conditions of approval under the CUP staff report, but we discussed earlier moving condition number 3 for the agricultural mitigation plan with moving that to the AC-153-24 portion of it, so that condition will be directly tied to the comprehensive plan amendment, if that makes sense. So, we can review some of the conditions of approval, but the one that we had sort of a conversation about was condition number 3, which is to submit the agricultural mitigation plan that includes an economic impact analysis evaluating the impacts of the facility and the removal of that acreage from agricultural production. And the relevance there is that a lot of these solar and wind and other energy facilities that we end up reviewing, when we're doing these Goal 3 exceptions, on a broad level, we don't want to set a precedent that the additional tax revenue would be an adequate offset for removing land from agricultural use when we're reviewing Goal 3 exceptions. And so this is a relatively small project, and they have a really interesting and kind of innovative solution that includes grazing on the site, and I'm sure the applicant will get into that in a little bit more detail. But kind of on a broad level, we just wanted to make sure and set a precedent that when we are removing land from agricultural production, we're taking a really specific look at how that agricultural impact is offset, not just that it's creating more economic value. So that's kind of a high level. There's a lot of information here. There's a lot of attachments and, studies and supporting evidence. And I'm happy to answer questions from a staff perspective. And, of course, the applicant's going to be able to give, more information on that as well. But do you guys, at this point, have questions?
I think the applicant's
going to
go into a little bit more specific detail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's questions would be for the applicant.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the gist of it. Go for it.
Not too hard, no. I can state my name for the record while we're pulling this up. My name is Nathan Stotler. That's NathanStotler. Address 2003 Western Avenue, Suite 225, Seattle, Washington, 98121.
My name is Tanner Gillespie. I'm a Project Manager at One Energy. Same address, location.
Just spell your name.
Tanner, T-A-N-N-E-R, Gillespie, G-I-L-L-E-S-P-I-E.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We appreciate everyone taking some time out of their lives to come hear our presentation tonight. As you know, we're here with One Energy Renewables. We've been working on the Passage Solar Project in Morrow County for about a year now. Tanner and my team have worked on putting together the very thorough application in front of you. We're going to hit the high points here in our presentation tonight and then take some questions. So, quick agenda. I'll introduce One Energy, talk about some work that we've done in Morrow County previously, and then run through the very basics of solar. I'm sure you all are very well aware of a lot of that. And then we'll talk about the project itself, get through the specifics of it. Elaine is on the line. She'll be talking about our code compliance at the state and county level. And then we'll open it up to questions at the end. One Energy was founded 15 years ago in Seattle. We have offices now in Portland, Denver, Madison, and Washington, D.C. as well. Tanner and I are both based out of our Denver Boulder office. We are a 75-person company that includes our development department that Tanner and I sit in, as well as engineering and construction management. One Energy has developed solar assets in terms of, you know, what we developed that's operational today. We have 1.2 gigawatts that's spread across 120 projects. A lot of those we've sold to other developers who have then built them and owned them. One Energy has recently, in the last few years, moved into building its own projects. So right now, of the projects that One Energy has built or is currently building, we have 270 megawatts, then that's spread across 47 projects. As I said, my name is Nathan Sotler. My position at One Energy is Associate Director for Development on our West team. So I work on projects from the Great Plains all the way through Mountain West and then up in the Pacific Northwest. Tanner Gillespie works with me, as well as Anna Lynch, who joined us tonight. And yeah, that's our team. And then, like I said, Lane Oberg is on the line with us as well. So One Energy seeks and develops solar sites that are chosen for their ability to be low impact and high benefit for the land, for the landowner, and for the communities that we work in. This strategy has resulted in a pipeline of 4,000 megawatts worth of projects. And that's our coast-to-coast pipeline today. As I said, you know, it very much focused on this low impact and high benefit method of doing so. And that's, like I said, yielded us quite a few projects. So we see solar as a great product for the state of Oregon for several reasons. One being the state and the utilities in the state have very high targets for renewable energy. That's one of the things that brings us here. Solar is also very compatible with agricultural uses, a point that we're going to dive into deeper a little bit later in the presentation. Solar is also not a permanent use, so the land that we're going to build on, wherever we are, is easily and pretty affordably restored to whatever use it was beforehand. So removing solar farms is not detrimental to the land. It doesn't cost anything more than what the parts are worth after they're done being used, and can be restored to ag use very easily. And then finally, solar is a quiet, emissions-free, and low-maintenance use for the land for the lifetime of the project. As I mentioned, One Energy has some experience permitting solar farms in Morrow County. 2018, we permitted both the Tower Road Solar Project and the Harp Solar Project. One Energy developed those projects all the way to being ready for construction, sold them to other developers, and I don't believe either of them have been built yet. As I said, I'm sure all of y'all are pretty familiar with how solar works, so I'm going to hit the basics very quickly to make sure we're on the same page. So solar, in our case, is talking about solar photovoltaic panels, which are cells of silicon that are sandwiched in between sheets of glass. They convert sunlight into electricity. The glass is textured and treated with anti-reflective coating to reduce glare. The foundations for the solar panels are steel piles that are driven directly into the ground. With the pile driver, sometimes if there's rocky soils, it might need a little bit of pre-drilling, but very rarely is there any concrete or any other footing involved. It's just steel into the dirt. And then the solar panels are mounted on what's called trackers. The trackers, they tilt from east to west to follow the sun over the course of the day to keep the solar panels pointed toward the sun to maximize their energy production. Inverters are sort of next up in where the power moves from the solar panels through some wires into inverters, which turn it from direct current into alternating current. There'll be several of these inverter pads that you can see scattered throughout the site. Power then flows from the inverters to the interconnection infrastructure. This is a transformer that steps up the voltage to meet the transmission level voltage that moves the power on through the grid. The interconnection infrastructure also includes communications and protections, breakers, and things to isolate the solar project if it needs to be, and to make sure that our connection with the grid is smooth. Finally, perimeter fence up to 8 feet in height installed around the perimeter of the project. These are wildlife-friendly fences, woven wire mesh, as you can see in the detailed picture there, usually with wooden posts. These are in compliance with ODFW standards. And the fence height and gates, working with county and emergency service access needs as well. And then the roads are built to fire code for safe access. So they have the appropriate number and location for turnarounds built 20 feet wide per international fire code. And then we make sure we work with the fire department to ensure that they've got the access that they need for their specific equipment. And then the last part is the battery energy storage system. So this is, in our case, something that we wanted to have the option to use on our site. It's not for sure that we're going to be doing battery storage, but we want to permit it with the assumption that it's there. Battery storage is becoming increasingly common for most solar facilities getting permitted today. And the battery storage can serve one or more of several different functions for the project and for the electric grid. It can capture curtailed energy to make sure that nothing's wasted, so when there are times where grid doesn't need any more energy, we can store it for when it does need it. That usually being for solar, when we're producing most of our energy in the middle of the day, but most energy gets consumed in the evening hours, so we can store it in the middle of the day and then put it on the grid when it's needed in the evening. Also helps to increase reliability and smooth out the power on the grid. Those are sort of the three main use cases for batteries today. So that's kind of why we wanted to include them in our permit. The battery modules themselves are housed in self-contained units like the white container boxes you see here. And these have built-in fire suppression systems located on isolated gravel pads, usually bigger even than the pads you see in this picture, usually quite a bit of space between the battery storage units and any sort of vegetation around them, just for fire safety purposes. And then One Energy ensures that the equipment that we select is going to meet reliability, safety, and fire standards. All right, so we'll jump into the project itself. We're located about 17 miles southwest of Hermiston. We're located on two different project parcels. You can see the white outline are the parcels themselves, and the red outline is the project area extent. The yellow line here is the generation tie route, so that we're connecting into Umatilla Electric Cooperative's Oregon Trail substation, which is the pin there. The yellow line is the transmission line that we'll be building to connect ourselves to the grid. We have site control via a long-term lease agreement that was signed about a year ago with Tim and Shannon Rust. The land is zoned for exclusive farm use. Project size, as Daisy mentioned, is 120 megawatts with 120 megawatt optional battery storage. And the way that that works is that between the solar and the battery, there's never more than 120 megawatts of power going onto the grid at any one time. It's not a 120 plus 120 thing. It's 120 of solar, and maybe at some time it's producing 80 megawatts of solar and 40 megawatts is coming from the battery, or but it's never more than 120 between the two. This is enough power to power about 22,000 average homes. The very earliest that we would be operational was its end of year 2025, so it would be a very early target. All right, so site overview. The site was selected following a pretty robust alternatives analysis, which you can find in your packet. We first identified a local transmission infrastructure owned by Umatilla Electric Cooperative that had sufficient capacity to essentially plug in a project of this size. It's 115 kV, so 115,000 volts is the infrastructure, which can usually take a project around this size, 100 to 150 megawatts. We then sought land near that infrastructure that would have low to no impact on many different factors. So habitat, irrigated and high-value farmland, cultural resources, wetlands, nearby residences, among others. And the project site that we've selected here, the land owned by Tim and Shannon, stood out to us because it met all of those criteria. because it was flat and very buildable. We don't have to do much grading at all, really, to the site to get it flat enough for solar. And because the landowners were interested in leasing the land for solar. So there's a lot of ideal solar sites out there, but you got to have a landowner that wants to work with you. So that was one of the big things as well. A few photos of the site here. You can see there's some existing wind farms nearby the site. And those are about the only structures that you can really see from the site itself. There's no residences or businesses near the project or really within seeing distance. The land is all currently farmed for dryland wheat. A crop comes off every other year with the land lying fallow on off years. So we have a few different area definitions from the packet that I wanted to walk through really quickly. The project tract itself is 5,800 acres, nowhere near the size of our project here. That's just the tract itself. Our project area extent is 753 acres. The project area, 738 acres. So the difference between the project area extent and the project area. So project area itself is the actual land it's going to take to build the solar farm. Project area extent is sort of the slightly larger area that we would like to permit for the solar use so that we can what we call micro-site the actual project within that. So there are a few studies left to be done before we can really get solid construction documents made for this project, one of those being geotechnical work. Very expensive geotechnical work. We usually don't do it until we have a permit in hand to go build the project. And so by permitting the project area extent for solar, it allows us to pick the best 738.6 acres within that 753 to put the solar farm. So we're only going to impact 738, but we're asking to consider 753 for solar.
Just quick, how do you define your project tract? 58, is that the contiguous ownership of the landowners?
Those are the parcels?
Parcel boundaries. That are project area extent sits within. So those two parcels are within
okay.
the county.
Yeah, the white outlines.
Yeah.
Is the
property. And those are all the made of rust properties, and you're just taking portions that 750 within that. Okay.
Right, yeah.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So that project will lie within that rem.
Okay.
Thank you for clarifying, Chandler. Yes, the white outline is project tract, and then the red is the project area extent. And then if you look at the zoomed in picture to the right there, you can see all of the black essentially are the solar arrays themselves. Purple are storage areas for during construction. They would be empty during the life of the project. So there's what we call lay down yards. So yeah, all of the areas within there that are not in solar make up that the difference between the 753 and the 738. All right. This is the project area extent overview. So within this area, based on all the studies that we've conducted, there are no impacts to high-value habitat. There are no impacts to irrigated soils. No impacts to NRCS Class 1 or 2 soils. There's only minimal impacts to other high-value farmland, and we'll jump into that, I think, in the next slide. There's no wetlands or floodplains on the site, no impacts there. Farming is going to continue across the remainder of the parcel and all of the adjacent lands, and we're proposing some switch from cultivation to grazing on our site. Solar is a passive technology that has no offset impacts, so our impacts are confined to the project area extent. So this is the due diligence that we've completed to date, a quick overview. Most of this has been complete. A few things are a little bit ongoing right now. Cultural mitigation discussions are ongoing with the consulting tribes. We have ongoing consultation with ODOT. We talked to them about access. They don't have an issue with our access. We don't need any additional permitting for access. Their only concern was about glare, and we're in the process of providing them with a glare report. That should alleviate the concerns for glare on the state highway. And then finally, the weed board and the fire marshal have provided feedback. Their consultation is ongoing only in so much that we need to provide our final vegetation management and site plans prior to construction. So we talked about the project area extent and then the final project area. So once that final project area is set, then they'll review those final plans and hopefully get their feedback. So this is high-value farmland definitions. So I wanted to talk about the types of high-value farmland that the project is impacting. There's a few different definitions, as we know, through the state definitions of this. A few of the big ones that we watch for when we cite solar projects in Oregon, first one being any land that's considered prime, unique, or class one or two soils. There are none of these in the project area. All of the soils on site are class three or higher. One of the criteria for qualifying for High Valley farmland is whether there are any water use permits existing for the land, or whether the land is in an irrigation district or an improvement district. There are no permits that exist for water use on this land, and the land is not in an irrigation district or an improvement district. All of the high value farmland identified on this site is what you see in red, and that is the American Viticultural Area land. So the American Viticultural Association has published a map of the state of Oregon, and any land that has a certain aspect, north-facing aspect, and a certain slope that would make it good for viticulture is included in that. There's not enough water, or there's not any water allocated to this parcel, and so you could not grow grapes on it. It's not anything that would ever really occur on the site in terms of, viticulture is not going to happen here, but the AVA releases this layer based on just those two things, slope and aspect, and so 153 acres of the site are in the AVA definition. So just to clear up what our impacts on how valuable farmland are, not based on soils, it's not based on water rights, it's based on just the AVA definition. All right, and I'm going to turn it over to Elaine. She's going to walk through the project's compliance with state and county standards.
Great, thanks, Nathan. I'm Elaine Albridge. I'm a partner at Davis Ray Tremaine, located in Portland. Before we move on to compliance with applicable standards, are there any questions about just the project itself or the project location or components or soils? Okay, we'll keep going then. So as Daisy mentioned, we are requesting two approvals from the county to authorize this project. We first need a Goal 3 exception to remove 739 acres of arable land to facilitate the siting of the project because it exceeds the 12 and 20 acre thresholds that Daisy discussed. So that's the first component. And then the second component is we're requesting conditional use permit to actually authorize the siting of up to 120 megawatts on that 739 acres. Next slide. Next slide, please.
Are you doing the slides? Or are you?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thanks. First, I want to talk about the Goal 3 exception. So for Goal 3, the test is a four-part test. It requires that the applicant demonstrate that reasons justify an exception. Two areas not requiring an exception cannot accommodate the project. Then requires balancing of what we call the EC elements to ensure that the project location is not resulting in significant adverse impacts that wouldn't otherwise result cited elsewhere. And then four, that the proposed use is compatible with adjacent uses. And we have demonstrated through our application, and I think you'll see in the staff report, that the applicant meets each prong of this test. Next slide, please. So for the first prong, reasons justifying an exception, there are different factors that go into our compliance with this prong of the test. The first one is that the county has adopted comprehensive plan goals and policies that support the exception and are furthered by the project. Those are found in the energy conservation element, the economic element, and the public facilities and services element. I'll defer to the staff report and their proposed findings on pages cited, and as applicant supports the staff's recommended findings on this aspect of the test. Second, the solar PV project is a locationally dependent rural industrial use under DLCD's rules, and that in and of itself justifies an exception. By definition, the solar PV facility is a rural industrial use, and we have subsequently demonstrated that that rural industrial use is justified because it's locationally dependent. The factors that we have considered for locational dependency in this circumstance is the area of high solar insolation rates, so good solar resource, The second is proximity to existing infrastructure with UEC's Oregon Trail substation. And even more importantly, that proximity is that it's technically and economically feasible to interconnect with the Oregon Trail site. It has sufficient capacity and it avoids cost prohibitive upgrades, meaning that power can get onto the grid right away. Next slide, please. And the second element, or the second prong of the test is the alternatives analysis. Applicant provided an alternatives analysis that was helped prepared by Tetra Tech, our consultants. You'll see that in attachment R in the record, and proposed findings are addressed on page 13 of the staff report. I'll go briefly through the alternatives analysis, and I'm happy to answer more questions about it if we have some. But essentially, the applicant identified the 9 minimum siting criteria that would be required for an alternative to be considered reasonable. You know, those factors considered a variety of considerations, including appropriate site, transmission, topography, willing landowner, minimal environmental impacts, like not a site with high environmental resources, things like that. The applicant and Tetra Tech use the ARC map and publicly available data. There are maps included in the alternatives analysis that will walk you through the different steps that applicant took in order to do the evaluation for potential alternatives. One site was identified as a potential alternative. That site was then evaluated further and disqualified as not being reasonable, which led us to the proposed site today. The third prong of the test is the EC analysis. Again, I'm going to defer to the staff report and the proposed findings that you find there. Those findings address, you know, the environmental, economic, social, and energy consequences of the project, and conclude that the project will not result in significantly adverse impacts in its current location or any other location. And fourth, finally, the fourth prong is compatibility with adjacent uses. The adjacent uses, as you could see from the aerial photograph, is other agricultural operations. And again, defers to page 16 in the staff report for the recommended proposed findings to support a conclusion that the proposed facility is compatible with those ongoing ag operations. One thing we wanted to touch on directly was the effort to minimize and mitigate impacts to agricultural land. First, we looked at minimizing impacts to productive agricultural land through micro-siting and site selection. Nathan talked a bit about this, of how One Energy goes about looking for sites, really trying to find a site that has lower productivity, doesn't have water rights, doesn't have high value class one and class two soils, minimizes impacts to other high value farmland categorized soils. And so that's how we ended up really narrowing down on what is defined in the application as the project area extent out of that larger project tract, and how we targeted the project tract itself. And you'll see attachment B is the landowner support letter in the record that goes to help support the reasons for why this project site is warranted under Oracle exception. But the second part of this is mitigating impacts to agricultural land. And from our position, we're really excited to talk about the implementation of this grazing program. Nathan's gonna talk more about it on the next slide, but just to introduce it, is that this is something that's somewhat newer in Oregon being introduced. One Energy is actually familiar with it in some of its other projects in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And so we're now starting to see this coming to fruition here in Oregon, which is really exciting because it actually means that there is going to be ongoing farm use of the solar project site, even though there will be the operating solar facility. So this is the ideal of what we've been looking for and trying to really implement what's called agrivoltaics. And so we're going to hear more about that tonight. There's other projects across the state who are looking to implement and are implementing these similar grazing programs. There's a recent example in your neighboring county, in Gillam County, for the Montague Solar Facility. That was recently approved to revise their existing mitigation and re-veg plans to incorporate grazing as an element in their vegetation management. So that project will now have sheep grazing occurring concurrent with the solar facility operations. So with that, unless there are any questions about the Goal 3 exception test, I will turn it back over to Nathan.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? And Elaine's somewhat of an expert in the state on solar. So Elaine, by virtue of the fact that they met DLCD's definition of industrial for purposes of solar, is that in and of itself enough to justify the Goal 3 exception? Is that what I heard you say?
The second prong of it is still the locational dependency. So needing to prove up that, one, it's a rural industrial use and that it is locationally dependent. And so that's kind of two factors. So we fall within the definition by the plain language of the rule. And then we demonstrated through evidence in the record the locational dependency factor.
Okay, thank you. I'm still trying to wrap my head around it.
Yeah, and one thing I do want to note for the record, we did address in the staff report, staff had raised a question about mitigation for agricultural land, recognizing that some of the larger projects that Morrow County is seeing are proposing agricultural mitigation plans. And our project, we think, is a little bit different than some of those larger projects, given its scale and its size and its site. And so instead of an agricultural mitigation plan, we are proposing this grazing program as an element of the project's vegetation management plan. And so we provided some supplemental information and proposed findings on that aspect of the project's compliance with Goal 3.
And that was a letter that Tim distributed right before the meeting?
That's this.
All right. Yeah, and I can talk a little bit about essentially what's in there. There's obviously a lot more detail than what I'll touch on here, but like Lynn was saying, there's sort of two prongs to the grazing approach for us, or two reasons why we would do it. The first is vegetation management. So One Energy, as Elaine mentioned, we are currently grazing 7 different solar projects in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and the reason for all of those was vegetation management. So instead of paying somebody to come out and mow the grass 3 times a year, you don't have to mow that often in Oregon, but in Minnesota and Wisconsin, a little bit more so, we will pay a local grazer to come graze their sheep on the site instead. They take care of the vegetation, we don't have the emissions, it costs about the same, and then the local grazer has the benefit of not having to rent out pasture land for their sheep. So it works for us on that approach, and then it works, of course, in terms of keeping the land in ag use. We know it's a growing concern in Morrow County and Eastern Oregon. We're seeing a lot more solar farms applying for permits, especially solar farms that are much larger than ours. But it's a growing concern here. It's a growing concern in Colorado, where Tanner and I live and work a lot. And so we're trying to build up our ability to graze more and more of our sites to keep land in ag use and make sure that the land is benefiting the larger agricultural economy of the community. And you know, this, you know, like I said, we have sites we're grazing already. There are several other projects in Oregon and Washington that are grazing as well. So this isn't really, it's not a pilot program. This isn't a new thing. At One Energy, we've really fine-tuned our ability to design the sites to be very compatible for sheep grazing. There's a few things that go into that. One is running very clean and tight construction space. Making sure we're not leaving any loose wires hanging out. We're cleaning up all of our clippings. Sheep, you know, eat a lot of stuff, and if they get, you know, a little bit of copper wire in them, it's not good for them. So, you know, doing good construction management is part of that. Wire management is a big part of that. Ensuring we have good fencing and our fencing install is very clean and tight. And then providing adequate access for ranching vehicles as well. Normally we're, you know, once the project is fenced up, we're just providing access for pickups and maybe a fire truck, but you know, we need ranchers to be able to come in, turn around semis with sheep in them, or even just pick up some trailers, that kind of thing. So making sure that we're working with the ranchers to design the site to be accessible for them, making sure that we're providing water access to make sure sheep have water to drink. And then the other part of that is, it sort of ties back to the vegetation management a little bit, is what do we plant the land with when it's done? So very historically, you think about a solar farm, you might think about a solar farm in the desert of Nevada or Arizona. You look under it, nothing's growing under it, it's all gravel. Even when we are not grazing our solar farms, we're not leaving them as gravel anymore. That's not necessary. So all of the solar projects that One Energy has built either have native plants and grasses, pollinator mixes. We've done a lot of I think, bee farming and such on a few of the projects in Wisconsin as well, or they're grazing. So we're making sure that we're working with local ag extensions or, you know, folks like that to make sure we're planting the right things, that we're going about doing it correctly. So the other part of that is making sure that we get vegetation established so that we're keeping weeds down. We don't have to go out and worry about weeds for the perpetuity of the project. The sooner we get good vegetation established, the less we have to worry about weeds. So there's many prongs to this. And in this case, if we're going to graze the site, then we're going to work with the extension, work with the grazer to spec the right mix of species out there, whether it's native or naturalized grasses, legumes, that kind of thing, to make sure we have good forage for the sheep. I think I've touched on most of it. I have a lot of text on that slide, but I think I've touched on most of it there. Yeah?
Is it okay if I ask a question?
Yeah.
So you will do your initial, I'm not a farmer, well, not anymore, but you do your initial planting and then you plant your solar arrays. What if the sheep just happen to overgraze? Then how do you seed underneath the solar panel?
Yeah, so that is, seeding in general in the West is difficult. Obviously, we don't have irrigation on this land today. So getting something established, especially native seeds, is a little bit tougher to grow than wheat or something like that, or to get it established anyway. So we've worked with a few different very experienced contractors in the West in our projects in Colorado and New Mexico to get vegetation established. And what it is we use hydromulch with a tackifier, and usually just sort of pump the seed count up so that we're putting down more pounds per acre than what we normally would. So the hydromulch, it helps retain moisture on the surface of the soil and adjacent to the seed. So, you know, rain comes at a very certain time of year in the West, whether you're Colorado or Washington or elsewhere. The hydromulch holds the seed in place so it doesn't blow away and the soil doesn't erode until that moisture arrives and the seed's able to germinate. We also include what's called a tackifier. It's an organic substance that's just, it's sticky, holds things in place a little bit better, again, to prevent erosion. That's usually what it takes and holds things in place. And yeah, you definitely have to reseed sometimes. You may not get 100% coverage on your first seeding. You go out, you know, after a season and reapply as necessary until you get it where you need it to be. So, we need full vegetative coverage, not just for the grazing, but for, like I said, erosion purposes, stormwater purposes. We need to make sure that the ground is covered with vegetation. So we're doing, you know, everything we can to make sure that happens, and weed purposes.
Just so you know, we farm.
I assume everybody in the room farms.
Well, similar in a similar type of area, and it's a challenge to get grass established even under perfect conditions. I like the theory of the hydromulching. So you spray the entire 800 acres to a hydromulching, and
it's a lot of hydromulch. Yes, but yeah, that's what it. That's just what it takes. If you just seed it, you're going to go back year after year after year, so the hydromulch is what it takes, and
we see it mechanically under what we think sometimes are the best conditions, it's still a challenge. And then after construction, it's really a challenge because the soil's compacted.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. We do end up in a lot of places. We'll end up having to go till and make sure it's.
What's the rainfall in the area? The other areas where you've tried this annual precipitation.
The driest place that we built the project is Montezuma County, Colorado, so right in the southwest corner. You get 9 inches here, something like that, annually? I want to say right around there, maybe a little bit less. We have a project in Mesa County, too, Colorado. I think they get like 4 inches in Mesa County. And it may not grow immediately. It may not grow that first season. You may get some, but you got to stay on it. We may not be able to graze it